This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Ellen L. Walker. We're talking about a growing minority in the developed world of people without kids. Ellen, we have Mother's Day and Father's Day, but I think Kara Swan's idea of World Child Free Day is a real winner. Are we ready to celebrate people who don't add more humans to the planet?
I say yes. I'm talking right now about how to get this organized. I think that this could be such an exciting thing to actually have a day where those of us who have chosen or just simply by default, we have not added to the carbon footprint, for us to be thanked and recognized and given a little bit of appreciation for that.
Plus, you contribute a lot to society by working full careers without a break, really.
Right.
One thing I like about your book, Complete Without Kids, it isn't a manifesto or a single-sided rant. You do lay out a lot of options, and you leave room for doubts. What are some of the things people facing this situation should think about?
One of the big things a person facing this situation needs to think about is the idea that it's normal to have doubt and to have grief and to realize that by not becoming a parent, you are going to feel like an outsider a lot of times, and that you are going to have times when you have regrets about your decision, that those are normal feelings.
And women seem to bear the social and emotional load of this issue. What about the men?
Most of the men that I have talked to don't really seem to have any regrets. I don't think men have that pressure to become dads, whereas mothers, we so often hear that being a mother is the most important role that a woman takes on in her life, the central role.
Let's imagine two different listeners. One is 20-something, wondering or worrying about kids or not, and the other is 40 and child-free so far. Would you have different messages for each of them?
Well, yes, I would have different messages. The 40-year-old, it almost seems like she's at a place where she's probably not going to have kids if she hasn't by now. And she's probably needing to find a way to have peace and closure with her decision. So that would be what I would work with that woman on. It's just really embracing where she is. The other woman, what I would be encouraging her to do is to really be examining this decision as she would any other decision, whether it's what do I want to major in college? Where do I want to live in the world? Do I want to live in the city or in the country? Am I straight or am I gay? Or, you know, just big decisions that people really grapple with and sometimes sit on the fence with, that having a baby is probably the biggest decision a person will ever make in their life. And to look at it in that way instead of just allowing time to pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your book makes clear the experience of being child-free is not fully resolved for some people. There are 80-year-olds who still have doubts or even regrets about the children they did have or the children that they didn't. So aren't we humans always kind of unfinished business?
I think we are. Yeah, most of us are. And I think that's okay. I myself have doubts about this at least once a month. I'll have the thought, oh my gosh, I wish I had a little girl to take care of. Or, you know, I feel sometimes sad that I'm not planning my daughter's wedding. And I know that I'm never going to plan my daughter's wedding. But then I have to think about the things that I've been able to do because I didn't become a mom that my friends who are mothers can't possibly ever do in their lives because they've spent 20 years parenting.
As we, you know, head towards a wrap-up here and we're looking at online resources, you mentioned NoKidding.net, which I noticed was founded in Vancouver. What is that about?
NoKidding.net is a bit of a radical group. It's a social group, but their focus is not that they're anti-children, but they'll come out and say they don't want to be around kids. these people are not the ones that want to adopt their niece's softball team, for example. That's not their reputation. But they're a social group for people who don't have children.
But not everybody feels that way. Do you have other resources for people thinking about being child-free?
I do, and a lot of those are now on my website, which I'm trying to keep updated all the time. So I would encourage people to look there at some links.
So that's CompleteWithoutKids.com.
Uh-huh, right.
All right, CompleteWithoutKids.com is a good place to go and find out more to follow up on this. Our guest is Dr. Ellen L. Walker, a clinical psychologist, out with her first book, Complete Without Kids, An Insider's Guide to Child-Free Living by Choice or by Chance. And I have to say, listeners, there aren't a lot of good books to help people decide about having kids or how to live child-free. And I think this one fills that gap well with some interesting case studies without any of the psychological, you know, academic kind of talk. I like this book, and I want to thank you, Ellen, for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith.
Baby, you're the woman I love, and I love what it's doing to you. Having my baby, you're a woman in love, and I love what's going through you. The need inside you, I see it showing. Oh, the seed inside you, baby, do you feel it growing?
Hi there, you just heard two versions of the classic Having My Baby, released by Paul Anka in 1974. The first one you heard is a recent cover by the cast of Glee. In 2006, a CNN poll voted it the number one worst song of all time. Do you feel the warm glow? We all have baby lust built into us, a yearning and a duty hardwired into our brains, and just like bacteria, we'll do it until we bust the world.
Food and fuel hoarding have led to shortages, which erupted into looting incidents throughout Asia and South America.
Speak out. Head to populationspeakout.org to find out more. Populationspeakout.org. And I've got a few other free audio downloads on the Population page of our Audio On Demand menu right on the main page of ecoshock.org. It's time for the Population Bomb. Let's talk with Paul Ehrlich. At age 78, he's smarter than I'll ever be, with stamina to fight on while others give up. When it comes to population, the name Paul Ehrlich inevitably comes up. In 1968, Dr. Ehrlich published The Population Bomb. About 40 years and 40 books later, this distinguished scientist comes to us with a new book called Humanity on a Tightrope. Dr. Ehrlich, it is an honor to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you.
Well, first off, you have an authoritative co-author for this project. Can you tell us just a little bit about Robert E. Ornstein and how you two came to write this book?
Well, Bob and I have been friends for years, and he's a very distinguished psychologist, noted for some of his early work in split brains, for a number of great books explaining what we know about how the brain works. And we're both very, very concerned about human behavior in various dimensions, so we decided that it was time to write a second book together. We wrote one about 20 years ago called New World, New Mind, so this is in a sense a follow-up.
Listeners and readers may be surprised to find your new book is not really about population. Instead, you propose a common tool we'll need to face the many threats to civilization, things like climate change and polluted oceans and so on. So, Dr. Ehrlich, what is the common human ability that we need to develop?
Well, we already have one that allows us to put us in each other's shoes, and that's a very unusual trait for an animal, but we have it. And it's a critical one, and we do it automatically in small groups because, for most of our evolutionary history, we've been a small group animal. We lived for hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens, and before that as other species, in groups of 50 to 150 people, where we could easily tell what was going on in the minds of other individuals and, in a sense, feel what they were feeling. We actually have nerves that are designed in our brain to let us put ourselves in other people's shoes. And that's a really crucial thing, which we need to spread much further these days.
And part of your exploration is the positive and negative implications of our feelings for family. How should we rethink all that?
Well, first of all, human beings have come up with, particularly since the time of the agricultural revolution, with all different kinds of family structures, many of which work well, some of them don't work so well. I mean, the current myth that human beings are designed to be monogamous, one man doing the work, one woman raising the kids, and 2.4 kids who never think about drugs or sex, simply doesn't exist. It existed in the mind of some right-wingers for about 5 years after 1945, but we've found as a species all different kinds of family arrangements, and what we need to do now is design an overall family arrangement which lets us put ourselves in the shoes not of 100 or 150 other people, but something like 7 billion other people. We're a small group animal faced with the problem of figuring out how to live peacefully in gigantic groups and treat each other and our environments in ways that will allow our civilization to persist.
Well, if I'm being honest here, I'm not really convinced that feelings for distant humans will win out. I think of libertarians like Ron Paul. He wants to end foreign wars, but also foreign aid. And in its economic troubles, America may withdraw into isolationism again. So what are the signs that empathy is growing?
First of all, you got to look at what time course you're talking about. By the way, I'm talking to you about what will be required if we're to reach a sustainable society. Nowhere is it written that we will. Many civilizations in the past have collapsed, and we are now facing the first global collapse of a civilization. And I'm not sure where I would put my money anymore. I would tend to put it on we're not going to do the obvious things we should do to prevent it. On the other hand, if you look at the last few hundred years, for example, sorts of things we've done that cheer me up is we got rid of at least slavery in the United States, at least open slavery. When I was a kid in the 30s, if you were a woman, your choice of jobs, if you wanted one, was going to be a grammar school teacher, a nurse maybe, or a secretary, and that's it. Now, I'm an instrument-rated pilot, and I ended up taking my instrument training from a woman pilot. And today, many of your listeners probably have flown on airliners piloted by women. That's a change in the right direction. You know, it's World War II. Changed our view of what women could do, and also changed race relations. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan in the 1940s, and when Jackie Robinson broke in 1948, there were big discussions about whether people with dark skin could actually play sports. And, of course, before that, in the 30s, lynchings were common. So we haven't gone far enough on gender equity or on racial equity, but we've come a very long way in just one short lifetime. So, you know, we have changed in the right direction in the past, just not far enough, and now we got to do it really fast.
You know, reading your book did bring some dark doubts to my mind. For example, I'm thinking of the many people in the land of cars and supermarkets that they think they're green or progressive, but they still somehow expect a billion or more people will die off, and they're confident it will be them, those other people on the other side of the planet, and not us here at home. But is that really how it could play out?
Personally, I don't think so. In other words, I don't think those people understand how tightly our fates are tied to people in the rest of the world and how much we've got to care, not just about them, but about our descendants. I have a great-granddaughter that I would like to see have a wonderful world. Think about it for a minute. There are 1.6 billion people utterly dependent on the ice and snow of the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau for their agricultural water. There are people who are already having problems with their food supply because the warming of the planet has cut the productivity of the grains, wheat and rice, that they are dependent upon. If the agricultural water dries up, you're going to have a horrendous situation there among people who are already well armed with nuclear weapons. And the most recent studies show that, for instance, if India and Pakistan get into it with a relatively small nuclear war, a few hundred Hiroshima-sized weapons, 15 kilotons, or firecrackers by today's standards, that would end the civilization in the United States and Europe. So, you know, things are not exactly charming, and we really have to do something about it.
And also, I guess if we let a few billion people starve away in slums, we also have a disease-breeding mechanism, and it only takes one day for the airplane to arrive with that disease here.
Absolutely. The rapid transit systems, a growing population increases the chances of a nasty disease jumping from animals to human beings, like AIDS did recently, like all our infectious diseases did at one time or another. The disease situation is horrendous. The toxic situation is horrendous. In some subarctic villages, there are roughly two times as many girl babies born as boy babies, even though the normal sex ratio is 105 boys roughly to 100 girls. And that is a sign, going along with things like intersex alligators and frogs with five legs and so on, that show us that the hundreds of thousands of toxic chemicals that we've spread from pole to pole are not harmless and could very well turn out to be even more serious than climate disruption as far as our future options go.
And I'm surprised you de-emphasize population, though, in the book. It seems like your ship is coming in now. I'm thinking of the tensions in Egypt, double the population since 1980, 50% unemployment. Do you think the crisis you predicted in 1968 is really starting to boil now?
Oh, first of all, one of the complaints about the population bomb was that we said the battle to feed all of humanity is over. Well, that was 1968. There were 3.5 billion people. About 500 million were hungry. Now we've got 7 billion people, and about 1 billion of them are hungry. In other words, the prediction saying that, oh, we'll easily take care of 5 billion people, technology will do it, don't worry about it, simply haven't come true, and population is a huge element in it. The problem is, if we want to humanely deal with population, it's going to take us many decades, which means we should have started long ago, we should be starting right now. Our biggest tool at the moment, besides having to start on a population issue, because if we don't do that, we'll never get anywhere, is we've got to change our consumption patterns. And we've got to change the system of stealing from the poor and giving to the rich, which in the United States and the world as a whole has been so successful since Ronald Reagan instituted the program.
Well, just before we get back to your new book, I have one further question from a listener sent in, and he asks, Dr. Ehrlich, have you looked into how declining or more expensive fossil fuels will impact population?
Well, more expensive fossil fuels are already impacting population in the sense that they're increasing hunger in the world. The food riots trace in part to our attempts to keep the fossil fuel flows up, and by converting corn into the equivalent of a fossil fuel, that is, into ethanol. So there's no question our food system is incredibly dependent on fossil fuels, and we're not showing any sign of transitioning off of them, which means as the fossil fuels get more expensive, scarcer, and more importantly, as the climate system changes every more rapidly, it's going to clobber agriculture. You clobber agriculture where people get hungry and have nuclear weapons, and you can paint your own scenarios, and they're not going to be painted in sky blue happy colors.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Paul R. Ehrlich with his new book, Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. Well, Dr. Ehrlich, I found the book really started to shine with some of the solutions you and Robert Ornstein suggest. Maybe we could start with your own stomping grounds, the university system. What changes do we need to make there to survive into a future?
Well, first of all, we need to teach people how the world works. I'm at the greatest university in the world. It's been a wonderful place, but I would guess that 90% of our graduates and 90% of our faculty couldn't give you a coherent story of where your food comes from. Or as you ask the average American where their food comes from, the average educated American, and they'll say the supermarket. They have no idea, for example, but the huge connection between fossil fuel supplies and their food supply. They have no idea that the sort of cozy-sounding global warming may mean global getting rid of a lot of the food we need. And so the first thing we should do is start at the very bottom, of course, in our grade schools. In other words, we should get off of the See Spot Run reader and have one that says, see the plant grow in the sun, so that people would understand the connection between photosynthesis and their own lives. And go on right on up through closing what Ann and I call the culture gap, the fact that for the first time in human history now, the average person in our culture has less than a billionth of the information that's possessed by the culture as a whole, so that you have, for instance, a Congress full of people utterly clueless on how the world works. In other words, the people who claim to think that global change, that climate change, climate disruption is a hoax, just don't have a clue. It's very simple to teach someone how you know that the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are coming from burning fossil fuels. Nobody ever told them. And of course, they're, besides being pig ignorant, a lot of them don't want to learn. And so we've got to really start educating through our school system, changing our university structures. We have to develop 21st century universities instead of 19th century ones, and that's a big order too. There's a lot to do, and I can't tell you I'm thrilled by the prospects we're actually going to do it.
How could we translate your book to develop what I would call empathy activism? How do we make this work?
Well, I think one of the things that really goes for us is we're great social animals. We like getting together with other people, and we can get together with other people to solve problems. And a lot of people already do it. Look at the people who do charity work. Look at the people working in environmental organizations, NGOs, the Sierra Club, and so on, all trying to make a better world. That's the kind of thing we get the best chance of spreading, and it's got to come from the bottom up. And we're actually working very hard to organize the scholarly community to get the job done. We're bringing social scientists in to talk to natural scientists about how human behavior can be changed. We're getting people in the humanities involved, because we know just telling people the scientific results doesn't do it. You got to give it in the proper narratives. And we're trying to get the general public involved. Whether it'll work or not, who knows? But, of course, part of it is programs like yours and me raving on them to try and get people to thinking about these things and learning about them.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, you say in the book that we've passed the time where we need more physical science or more proof. What we really need is a rapid response team to figure out how to change human behavior. Could you tell us about the Millennial Assessment of Human Behavior, or MOB?
Well, the MOB is now an international group. It's really a network of people in the humanities, in the natural sciences, in the social sciences, and just interested people who have been talking together and working together about how to change the behavior of the people of the world, where we want to go, and how we can possibly get there. Because, again, the basic facts of the situation are now well known. Even the dumbest economist who writes for the Wall Street Journal knows that gasoline is underpriced in our country and should be much more expensive, so we cut driving the big cars and start phasing out fossil fuels and stop killing people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan to try and keep our flow of fossil fuels going. Everybody knows that. Try and politically to put a tax on gasoline and even start raising the prices towards what gasoline costs in Europe, and you'll be out of office. How do we change that behavior? And that's the discussion we're starting. And we've had some positive results, but it's still a baby at the moment.
But despite all the bad news, you and Robert also offer us page after page of hope. Why should we be hopeful?
Well, we should be hopeful because we can do it. It's not like, you know, the monster army from Mars is invading and they're 50 times as technologically talented as we are, and they're going to devour us. So, you know, there's a statement you're probably too young to remember. One of the greatest scientists of all time was named Pogo, and he came up with the straight answer. We have met the enemy, and he is us. And therefore, we have the capability of doing it. And in the past, we've seen very rapid turnarounds in attitudes. To just give you a relatively recent example, nobody I knew predicted that the Berlin Wall would come down and the Soviet Union would collapse as fast as it did, but it did. And our big hope is that we can change our behavior towards each other and towards our life support systems suddenly and rapidly so we can get the job done. And we know that given the right incentives, this sort of job, gigantic change, can be effected. In 1941, the U.S. produced almost 4 million passenger cars. And then December 7th came along, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and over the next 4 years, we switched to producing hundreds of thousands of tanks, hundreds of thousands of military trucks, over 300,000 military aircraft, dozens of aircraft carriers. We rationed meat, we rationed oil and gasoline, we rationed sugar, we designed and built nuclear weapons, we won the Second World War, and then that was only 4 years. And then the next year we turned it all around and went back to manufacturing automobiles and TV sets. In other words, when you have the right incentive, we could, for instance, do what Al Gore said we could do in much less than 10 years, and that is convert all electricity in the United States to not using fossil fuels. It would take a huge effort, a World War II style mobilization. That's what we need. We've got to recognize the enemy, and as I say, he is us.
Well, as we approach the close here, I wanted to ask you what research is interesting you the most these days.
Well, the research that's interesting me most is what we've been talking about. I've been working with several colleagues trying to figure out how culture, that is our non-genetic information, evolves. We have a pretty good picture, not complete and with some very interesting holes in it, of how our genetic evolution works. But we really don't understand our cultural evolution. The answer of, you know, why do you have Sarah Palin as a possible candidate for president? seems absolutely insane. We don't understand why you get that kind of anomaly. We've got to learn how to understand that sort of thing and how to steer people in a direction that's going to be useful for their survival and that of their children.
One of the problems I've been working on that kind of is part of that is we have a movement now, the transition town movement or the relocalization movement. People are trying to make face-to-face groups that are under that 150 small group animal level that you discuss in your book. And yet we've got these global problems, and you're suggesting we need global empathy. Are they contradictory moves?
No, they aren't. It's got to be a combination because first of all, we can be empathetic with more people. We actually can't avoid being empathetic to anybody we're exposed to. I mean, think about people. If you watch a television soap opera like Law and Order, if something happens to the hero, you feel bad. If you read a great novel and something happens to the hero, you can't help but feel bad. Our ancestors solved this same sort of problem when they put together 13 disparate colonies into a union where they tried to maintain individuality, smaller group functions, which they did quite effectively, and yet got together, all 13, to do things they couldn't do individually, like protect themselves from the British. And we face the same thing with nation states today. We can keep our individual groups and value them, but we can also value the larger groups and understand that what somebody does in Tibet affects our lives and vice versa, and that we've got to give up some of our sovereignty and develop some mechanisms for helping other people in the world because it's helping ourselves. If we do not stop the distribution of stuff from the poor to the rich and reverse it, if we don't start treating our environment right, we're all going to get out on the collapse. So we have to spread our empathy. It doesn't mean we lose our empathy for people that we know even more personally. We just spread it around.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He and co-author Robert Ornstein say we have an innate ability to understand and care about all humans. We need to redevelop that skill to survive in a troubled world. To understand how the book is humanity on a tightrope, Dr. Ehrlich, thank you for spending that time with us on Radio EcoShock.
My great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. You have heard it all. Check out populationspeakout.org. Download this program as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. And do something, damn it. I love you all. Thank you for listening. Next week, we'll join the people for a transition to a more sustainable world. We go out with music by Venice Beat with Tess Timothy.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, can survive, they may find.
Layer 2525. If man is still alive, if women can survive.
25, 25, 25, 25, 25. In the year